Welcome to AUSA's Army Matters Podcast. This is Thought Leaders with Joe Craig. My guests today are James McElroy and Gregory Sanders, authors of Bait, The Battle of Cam Duc. Both authors are former Army officers and Vietnam War veterans. James McElroy lived at Cam Duc and led an elite group of U.S. and indigenous special forces troops in the battle. Gregory Sanders witnessed a detailed analysis of the battle at the AmeriCal Division headquarters prior to a joint U.S. and South Vietnamese Army operation at and around Cam Duc in 1970. Jim and Greg, welcome to the podcast.
Glad to be with you.
Thank you.
So in the book, you call Cam Duc the least known and most misunderstood battle of the Vietnam War. So for our listeners, can you give us a quick overview of what happened and how it's been misunderstood?
Cam Duc was a U.S. Army Special Forces camp near the Laotian border of Quang Tin Province in Hai Corps, South Vietnam. And Ngoc Thi Bac was a temporary South Special Forces patrol base 5 miles south of Cam Duc. From May 10th to 12th, 1968, they were both attacked by two full regiments of the 2nd Division of the North Vietnamese Army. That would be 3,000 to 4,000 troops. And a hastily improvised air counterattack involving about 350 sorties of almost 150 combat aircraft in 3 days of ideal weather for visual flight totally ravaged the attackers. The more they massed to attack in clear daylight, the more they were annihilated by all that concentrated air firepower. The air counterattack continued for 2 days after the ground attack, and during those 5 days, B-52 strategic bombers dropped more than 19,000 bombs around Cam Duc.
Yeah, let me just add that a principal reason that it's a little-known battle is because it culminated the day before the Paris peace talks convened in Paris, and so the news of the battle was swamped by the opening of the peace talks, and it got scant attention in the news media. I think there was one paragraph on it in Time magazine and another paragraph in Newsweek, for example. Had it occurred outside of the context of the opening of the Paris peace talks, there might have been more attention paid to it by the news media.
Right. Now, you mentioned the Paris peace talks, and that obviously figured into the North Vietnamese strategy for it. So can you talk a little bit about why they decided to attack Cam Duc and Ngoc Thi Bac, and what were they trying to accomplish?
Well, at that time, there was nationwide attacks on 118 other targets in the second wave of the North Vietnamese Army's general offensive of 1968. It's called the Mini Tet. And so the whole country was under attack again, and that's another reason why very little attention was paid to Cam Duc. Mm-hmm. But most journalists didn't even know, that the camp existed, much less what was going on there, so that it was easily overlooked.
Yeah, and just to add to that, I think as a military objective, the Special Forces camp was not particularly enticing for the North Vietnamese. Jim and I both think that it was more of a means to gain momentum at the peace talks by showing the world that the North Vietnamese could overpower elite American troops, the special forces. In fact, they had a film crew that accompanied the two North Vietnamese regiments to film what they hoped would be a victory with film footage showing either corpses of special forces soldiers or prisoners of war, but it didn't pan out that way.
No. Now, in the introduction, I mentioned that you both have a personal connection to the battle. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, I lived at Cam Duc. I was stationed there, and I was there before the battle, during the battle, and then 30 years later, I returned to Cam Duc with a Joint Services Military Casualty Recovery Team. There were more missing in action cases from that battle than from any other battle in the 7 years of U.S. ground combat in Vietnam. And it was the most extensive project that the casualty resolution team ever had. They went back over and over again trying to find remains, and did find many, many remains of the 37 people that were Americans that were missing there, plus the plane crash of a C-130 and its crew, and 183 people aboard it. So it was a big project, and General Shelton, who was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at that time, was my Special Forces A-Team commander in 1967 in at Ha Khan in Quang Nai province. And he facilitated my return there with that team, which I appreciated very much, and gave me another perspective on the whole thing.
All right. And then, Greg, you had a connection coming in a few years later, right?
I did, although my connection is a little more tenuous than Jim's. Jim was at the camp and participated in the battle. I did not. My experience there occurred 2 years later in July of 1970, when the AmeriCal division decided to, for lack of a better term, clean up the area because some photo reconnaissance missions indicated that the North Vietnamese were making use of that area, and they were concentrated in sufficient numbers there that it made sense to go back and remove them from that area. So General Abrams, who was then the commander of the United States Military Assistance Command Vietnam, came to the division headquarters at the AmeriCal division, and I participated in a briefing of him about the operation to take back Cam Duc, which was called Elk Canyon. And I learned an extensive amount of information about what had occurred there in 1968. And it intrigued me literally for decades, and was a major impetus for my participation in writing this book.
Right. And Jim, you had mentioned that you were in the battle itself. You know, you had been stationed there at the Special Forces camp, but you actually left the camp in the beginning of May 1968, only to be sent back to prepare for what they said was going to be an imminent attack. Can you tell us what you did with that?
Yes, I only had 15 days left on my Vietnam tour, and the two regiments of the North Vietnamese division had surrounded that camp gradually and were shooting at planes and all that, and it was obvious they were going to attack it. And my function there was I was the officer in charge of the covert cross-border launch site for long-range reconnaissance commando teams into Laos, mm-hmm. and against the Ho Chi Minh Trail network, and we relied on helicopters, you know, for infiltration and exfiltration, and they couldn't fly because they were shooting them. In fact, they shot down one that had five of our American recon team leaders on it and killed all of them. And so it was no longer feasible as a launch site. And since I had only a few days left, I returned to my base, which was FOB-4, later called Command and Control North, just outside of Da Nang on the beach out there. And I thought that my tour was over until they told me, my commander told me he wanted me to go back out there and take charge of the SOG troops, because the camp was going to be attacked by this huge force. And so I was rather appalled because I thought I was going to go home safely, but it looked like I was going to be in a Vietnamese Alamo. And so I accepted my fate and went back out there and did the best I could to get them organized. And we fought off the largest ground attack after most of the reinforcement battalion had been evacuated, mm-hmm. and only a very danger close napalm strike saved us from being overrun at the very last there. So that was kind of my role in the battle.
Right. Now, in your discussion about the U.S. defense response, one of the things that really struck me was kind of the different ways that, you know, SOG and Special Forces and conventional Army were operating, you know, within the same area. Can you talk about the conflicts that arose?
Well, the Special Forces team there at Tamduck, where, you know, we were sort of their tenants. We, you know, we had a portion of the camp for our covert SOG launch operations. They had a completely different mission. They were advisors to the Vietnamese Special Forces team, who were the nominal commanders of the camp and its small battalion of civilian irregular defense troops. And so they had very little participation in the battle or anything else. They were really not very effective troops at all. And so we didn't interact or overlap or anything. They were not involved in cross-border operations. They were strictly in local patrols and not very many of those. And so there was no conflict. We were quite compatible with them. They were just like us in the sense that they had a different mission, but otherwise it was all the same family, so to speak. But our jobs were completely different.
Yeah, and let me add to that. I think that certainly at the division level, and perhaps to some extent at the Corps level, the border camp, the Special Forces camps along the Laotian and Cambodian borders were considered to be somewhat of a nuisance. The missions of the Special Forces and the conventional forces were not really integrated. And I think the conventional force commanders had little appreciation for what the Special Forces troops were doing. The command and control of all of the forces within each of the corps was less than desirable. It was not really fully integrated, in our view.
Right. I mean, I was struck, kind of a physical manifestation of those command and control issues you talk about, with, you know, the SOG camp being, you know, physically separated from the rest of the camp, and with permission to access being denied to some of the forces there to defend the larger Kamduk area.
There was probably no higher classified operation than SOG. So having them segregated and keeping their mission top secret was imperative. Is that not correct, Jim?
Yeah, absolutely. Very few people even knew that SOG existed, much less what it did. And the name itself was classified. And so it was referred to when it had to be referred to as command and control. That's all. Mm-hmm. So the regular troops, most of the Special Forces troops knew, you know, through the grapevine, just through, you know, conversations, et cetera, what SOG was generally about. But most of the regular troops had no idea that SOG even existed. So that's why it was so isolated.
All right. So, you know, you are talking in the book about the, you know, defending the camp there. But after a while, Westmoreland makes the decision to evacuate instead of sending in reinforcements like it did at Khe San. So can you talk about, what was behind that decision and how was it executed?
Yes. The camp really was not worth defending. It was an anachronism. It had been established there years before for a different reason, and that events had overtaken it. It was originally there to report on the infiltration of small groups of North Vietnamese disguised as Viet Cong and so forth. But by 1968, the North Vietnamese Army was overtly invading in, you know, uniformed conventional units. And so the border camps were really, they had outlived their purpose, except as launch sites for cross-border operations. That's what was Khe San was doing until it was abandoned. But Westmoreland never intended to defend Kamduk, and he I know that because he told Colonel Singlob, who was then the commander of SOG, that it was not worth defending. It was particularly when 118 other places in South Vietnam were under attack at the same time. The logistics, and it would have taken a very large unit of American troops to defend it against two regiments of North Vietnamese regulars. So it was never intended. And he made the decision before the main attack that he was going to evacuate it the next day. But that next day was May 12th, which was the major attack. So if it had not been for the Air Force and the Army and Marine helicopters, it would have been overrun, and everybody there would have been killed or captured. And the only reason it was not is because we had an extraordinary 3-day window of clear weather for visual flight, which made close air support possible.
Very unusual at that time of year, right?
Very much so. It was a transitional month for the southwest monsoon. And usually at that time, it was heavily overcast, sometimes for weeks at a time. And so the North Vietnamese were gambling that would, that would be the case. But the thing is that they were up against a deadline, and that is the Paris peace talks were going to begin on May 13th. And they felt they had to get that attack in just before that. So they couldn't afford to wait for the monsoon weather to close in. They had to attack then or not at all. And it was just a terrible slaughter from their point of view. We estimate conservatively that they must have lost at least 1,500 to 2,000 of their troops through air attacks alone.
Yeah, it's amazing what was brought to bear upon them. I mean, the different types of aircraft and the number of different munitions used against them. It was quite striking in the book.
And Joe, your question gets to the heart of another issue, which is how the war was fought and why it was fought the way it was fought. As Jim pointed out, the Special Forces camp had little strategic value. For example, after the siege of Khe Sanh ended, General Abrams made the decision to abandon Khe Sanh, and there was a hue and cry about the price that had been paid to keep it out of enemy hands after the siege was broken. To turn around and abandon it seemed like a huge mistake. Well, the fact of the matter is, Cam Duc, like Khe Sanh, could be taken back anytime the U.S. military deemed it advantageous. It was more about an opportunity to kill or take out of the fight as many conventional North Vietnamese troops as possible by executing an air ambush. That's essentially what happened at Khe Sanh and certainly happened at Cam Duc, as Jim has pointed out.
That's right. And also to keep in mind is that General Westmoreland's whole strategy was attrition. And it was, in effect, a strategy of tactics. And so the purpose of Khe Sanh was attrition, mass attrition of North Vietnamese Army troops. It's estimated that they lost between 10,000 and 15,000 of their best troops at Khe Sanh through air attacks. Combined with long-range artillery. But the same is true at Cam Duc. That was the only reason for not reinforcing it and not evacuating it before the attack, is that he actually welcomed the attack because that was what he was primarily trying to do, is cause as much attrition in the enemy forces as possible. But, of course, it was a gamble on the weather. And so he was basically gambling our lives that he would have a lucky weather window and he could use all that air power. And that's how it turned out, fortunately for us.
To underscore the point, it wasn't but about a half an hour after the last troops were evacuated from Cam Duc that a severe thunderstorm closed in and made tactical aircraft flight impossible.
Right. Wow. Yeah, so, I mean, you referenced earlier the dramatic difference between the casualties on the North Vietnamese side versus U.S. and the Allied side. So I'm just wondering, how was the battle viewed, today versus, at the time? And what lessons can today's Army take from the battle?
Well, I think those are two questions. How it's has been viewed before our book was written. And then secondly, what lessons the Army can take. I would answer the second question by saying that, in my opinion, the most important lesson is that the from the battle is the essential importance of unity of command in any large joint services combat operation. And that's what was missing at Camp Doug. All those different units did not have one single commander. And so they had to improvise, but they did so brilliantly for the most part. And they achieved with unity of action what was missing in unity of command. But it could easily have been a disaster because of the total lack of, you know, of unity of command. I mean, you had all those different units. You had Air Force transport planes. You had Air Force attack planes. You had Marine helicopters, Army helicopters. You know, you had the ground conventional troops, the reinforcement battalion of the AmeriCal division. You had the SOG troops. You had the indigenous troops of the Special Forces camp. And so it was just so many different units there, and they couldn't talk to each other. A lot of times they didn't have the right radios or the right frequencies. There was no rehearsal for it. And many times there was not even any briefing, but those pilots who were flying in there had no idea what they were flying into. And so it was highly fortuitous, really, that it turned out as well as it did because of the innovative ability of the various officers and NCOs in charge of the various units. It was a great example of extemporaneous coping with a chaotic situation or potentially chaotic situation.
A kind of improvised joint before there was joint.
Yeah, yes. I couldn't agree more. And I'm reminded of a comment that Stephen Ambrose, the well-known chronicler of World War II, said once. He was asked what spelled the difference between victory and defeat for the Allied forces. And he said, well, the primary reason we won is because of the ingenuity of the common American soldier.
An important point to always remember. So I want to thank you both for being our guests. James McElroy and Gregory Sanders have the new book, Bait, The Battle of Camp Doug. So thanks to you both for being our guests today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
And to all our listeners, thanks for joining. Be sure to subscribe to the Army Matters podcast on iTunes and everywhere else that podcasts are found. Visit AUSA.org for more information. Keep it locked here for all Army Matters and for next week's episode with Soldier Today. Have a great Army Day.